and seen on every continent in the United States in the world, and except Antarctica. And with Cindy and I have seen that, I think, in maybe six countries and seven different languages. So it was delayed in opening in the United States, but it had two runs in Great Britain, in London before that. And it did eventually open in New York City. And since then has been also all over the United States. And it's actually there's going to be a reading in a few days in Seattle again. So I'll let Cindy talk, I think, more about the other.
We visited the Nasrallah family in September of 2003. It was our first trip to the region. It was very important for Craig and me to see the place where Rachel had stayed and where her life ended. We traveled to Rafah with the help of our Palestinian friends who met us at Erez Crossing. And we were taken the very first day that we were there. We were taken to the area where the Nasrallah home still stood. And it was the only home left in that entire area. What I remember saying and feeling at the time was that house was sitting in a sea of rubble. Because the Israeli military was destroying homes wholesale. Later, Human Rights Watch said that happened in the absence of military necessity. And over 16,000 people, I think from 2000 to 2004, lost their homes at the time. That day, we sat on the floor in the Nasrallah family's home and ate a wonderful lunch meal with Om Karim, with Abu Karim, and with their very young children at the time. We were taken to the spot by Abu Karim, showing us exactly where Rachel had been when she was killed. It was a very emotional day. We hugged. We saw the rooms in the house where Rachel had spent time with the children and the family. They pulled off their Arabic English dictionary from the shelf and had me read, try to pronounce the words in Arabic, and they told me how Rachel was so much better at it than I was. And we saw also the space at the foot of the Nasrallah parents' bed, which was at the backside of the house, where Rachel would sleep, she said, in a puddle of blankets with the children, because military people and machines would drive through that border area at night and they would shoot into the houses. And there were bullet holes marking the entire home.
We just have 30 seconds, and I just wanted to get your final comment, either Cindy or Craig, on what is happening today.
Amy. That family did everything they could to hold on to that house. They were eventually forced out of that house, and some of them went through seven other houses. Now we hear that they want out of Gaza. After 21 years of trying to hold on to their homes and their lives and their futures and their past in Gaza, like so many people, they want to survive and they want out. I can't imagine what drives them to do that, but that's the situation. In
Well,
Gaza.
I want to thank you both for being with us again, Craig and Cindy Corey, speaking to us from Olympia, Washington. And Tom Dale will link to your piece in Jacobin, Rachel Corey Gave Her Life for Palestine, joining us from London. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Check out our website at democracynow.org.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a deep dive into two recent Supreme Court oral arguments that have profound implications for the First Amendment in the Internet age.
Our guest, Attorney Zach Wolf, will make a prediction on what he thinks the right-wing Supreme Court will do.
We'll also speak with award-winning author Robin Anderson about U.S.-Israel media genocide complicity.
There's no one in the country more knowledgeable than Robin Anderson. She's from Fair and Activist in the Media and Project Censored, and she'll give us her idea of what's going on with the media.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Last month, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments about two state laws that would regulate how large tech companies control what content can appear on their sites. Republican legislators in Florida and Texas aim to address what they claim are efforts to stifle conservative voices on platforms like Facebook and YouTube. In part, these laws came about after platforms banned Donald Trump for violating their rules against inciting violence in his posts related to the January 6, 2021 Capitol insurrection. The laws would compel companies to carry all users' viewpoints. It would also preclude them from deplatforming political candidates. The Florida law at issue in Moody v. Net Choice and its Texas counterpoint, Net Choice v. Paxton, represent challenges by technology lobbying groups, NetChoice and the Computer and Communications Information Association. The plaintiffs claim the laws violate their First Amendment rights to make editorial choices about what content to permit or to prohibit. They say it will be virtually impossible to monitor and prevent hate speech, pro-terrorism advocacy, and content that could harm children. Joining us today to share his reactions to the oral arguments is professor, author, and attorney Zachary Wolf. Zach, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Zach, we're going to begin with the opening statement of Henry Whitaker, the Solicitor General of Florida in Moody v. Net Choice. It's just under 5 minutes. Let's take a listen.
Moody versus Net Choice. Mr. Whitaker?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Internet platforms today control the way millions of Americans communicate with each other and with the world. The platforms achieved that success by marketing themselves as neutral forums for free speech. Now that they host the communications of billions of users, they sing a very different tune. They now say that they are in fact editors of their user speech, rather like a newspaper. They contend that they possess a broad First Amendment right to censor anything they host on their sites, even when doing so contradicts their own representations to consumers. But the design of the First Amendment is to prevent the suppression of speech, not to enable it. That is why the telephone company and the delivery service have no First Amendment right to use their services as a choke point to silence those they disfavor. Broadly facilitating communication in that way is conduct, not speech. And if Verizon asserted a First Amendment right to cancel disfavored subscribers at a whim, that claim would fail, no less than the claimed right to censorship failed in Prunard versus Robbins and Rumsfeld versus Fair. Social networking companies, too, are in the business of transmitting their users' speech. Their users are the ones who create and select the content that appears on their sites. The platforms indeed disavow responsibility for that conduct in their terms of service. Platforms do sort and facilitate the presentation of user speech. But this court, just last term in Twitter versus Tamina, and the platforms themselves in Gonzalez versus Google, described those tools as little more than passive mechanisms for organizing vast amounts of third-party content. The platforms do not have a First Amendment right to apply their censorship policies in an inconsistent manner and to censor and deplatform certain users. I welcome your questions.
Counsel, it would seem that this case is a facial challenge. And to some extent, it relies on the overbreath doctrine. But that seems to be an odd fit. since respondent represents virtually all of the platforms, and that it would be easy enough for a platform who's affected to bring it as applied challenge. Would you comment on that, or at least address the fact that this is a facial challenge?
Certainly, Your Honor. I do think that's a very significant aspect of this case. It comes to the court on a facial challenge, which means that the only question before the court is whether the statute has a plainly legitimate sweep. I actually don't understand them, Your Honor, to be making an overbreadth challenge, which, as I understand it, would rely on the effects on third parties. As I understand it, they're principally relying on the effects on their members. If they were bringing an overbreadth challenge, they would have to show various third parties.
Well, I think, how would they do that when they haven't shown that there are there's no way that this statute can be applied that's consistent with the Constitution? Have they met that?
They certainly have not, Your Honor. I mean, we think the statute has indeed a plainly legitimate sweep. And certainly there are a number of the platforms that are open to all comers and content, much like a traditional common carrier. And just as a traditional common carrier, consistent with the First Amendment, would be subject to hosting requirements, non-discrimination requirements. So too, we think that the platforms that satisfy that characterization, which are a number of them, absolutely would give this statute a plainly legitimate sweep.
This is such a odd case for our usual jurisprudence. It seems like your law is covering just about every social media platform on the internet. And we have amici who are not traditional social media platforms, like smartphones and others, who have submitted amici brief telling them that readings of this law could cover them. This is so, so broad. It's covering almost everything. But the one thing I know about the internet is that its variety is infinite.
That was Henry Whitaker in his opening arguments. Zach, both bills are overbroad in nature. They seek to restrict social media companies' ability to moderate content, particularly political speech. And that could result in far-reaching consequences beyond their intended scope. One problem being ambiguity of language. The Texas bill prohibits platforms from restricting users based on their, quote, political viewpoint, a term that could encompass a wide range of opinions. This vagueness raises the risk of arbitrary enforcement and legal challenges. By compelling platforms to adhere to specific moderation policies or to face penalties, both laws could undermine the legal framework that has enabled the flourishing of our internet. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. And it's not just that these laws are vague and overbroad, although they certainly are, but they're directed at activity that is just not the most pressing threat to the ability to have digital spaces and platforms that serve a democratic purpose, facilitate the sort of speech and expression that we need. It's basically cliche to say that social media addiction and its near displacement of traditional media has led to serious problems, misinformation leading to election denial and rioting, children engaging in self-harm, so many people facing hate speech and harassment. I believe we need to address that, but those serious problems aren't stemming from too much removal of harmful content. In other words, the Texas and Florida laws are not the sorts of reforms that we need. And despite the problems with these platforms, people stick with them because there's still hope that they can be valuable to us. You know, whether it's expression of a political view or need to reach out for a connection, social media is where we spend a great deal of our time. We can think about social media companies as sort of venue providers for our modern salons. The public needs to be able to secure a venue from a provider who is not obligated to escort in guests who are going to insist that school shootings are hoaxes, even if that individual makes a living as a journalist or if the state might consider that a viewpoint. It's important to remember that we're not talking about the state criminalizing speech. We're talking about whether it will be possible to engage in the kind of online activity that's become so much a part of people's lives without having to constantly confront posts claiming that your murdered child was a crisis actor and the school shooting was a hoax. And I'm using this particular example in the context of thinking about overbreadth because the Florida law, which in some ways appears to be more tailored, specifies, this is the quote, a social media platform may not take any action to censor, deplatform, or shadow ban a journalistic enterprise based on the content of its publication or broadcast. So this would appear to cover people and companies like Alex Jones and InfoWars, and the Texas law is even broader. It covers all viewpoint discrimination, which means that if a site wants to host content taking the position that school shootings are a major social problem, then it would not be able to discriminate against posts claiming that school shootings are hoaxes. And again, such claims might be constitutionally protected from state censorship, but that doesn't mean that it should not be possible for people to engage with each other over social media platforms without having those kinds of posts fed to us in the same way we get the posts that we want and need to engage with.
Now, Zach, after Henry Whitaker's opening statement, the court heard from Paul D. Clement, the former Solicitor General of the United States from June 2005 till June 2008. He's now an appellate lawyer. Let's hear what Paul had to say.
Mr. Clement?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Florida's effort to level the playing field and to fight the perceived bias of big tech violates the First Amendment several times over. It interferes with editorial discretion, it compels speech, it discriminates on the basis of content, speaker, and viewpoint. And it does all this in the name of promoting free speech, but loses sight of the first principle of the First Amendment, which is it only applies to state action. Florida defends its law, as you've heard this morning, principally by insisting that there's no expressive activity being regulated. That blinks reality. This statute defines the targeted websites in part by how big their audience is. It regulates the content and display of particular websites, and it tries to prevent my clients from censoring speakers and content. If you are telling the websites that you are that they can't censor speakers, you can't turn around and say you're not regulating expressive activity. It's all over this law. And that brings it squarely within the teaching of Tornillo, PG&E, and Hurley. All three of those cases teach that you cannot have the forced dissemination of third-party speech, and they reject considerations of market power, misattribution, or space constraints. And Reno and 303 Creative make clear those principles are fully applicable on the internet. Indeed, given the vast amount of material on the internet in general and on these websites in particular, exercising editorial discretion is absolutely necessary to make the websites useful for users and advertisers. And the closer you look at Florida's law, the more problematic the First Amendment problems become. It singles out particular websites in plain violation of Minneapolis Star. Its provisions that give preferences to political candidates and to journalistic enterprises are content-based in the extreme. I welcome the court's questions.
So, Zach, let's discuss the argument that Florida law interferes with editorial discretion, compels speech, and discriminates on the basis of content, speaker, and viewpoint. One issue is the extent to which platforms curate speech and free expression by the users. And for that, we know they enjoy broad First Amendment protection. But many sites also provide services, such as messaging, that do not require editorial supervision. These services, the justices are seeming to suggest, are akin to telephone or internet providers, and therefore can be subject to more government regulation. What's your take on that?
So in the clip that we just heard, the fact that they invoked Hurley and the 303 Creative cases is really important and I think quite telling here. In Hurley, Massachusetts wanted to apply its public accommodations laws to the organizers of the St. Patrick's Day parade, and it would require them to allow a gay organization to march with its banner. The Supreme Court said no, that even though this was a major public event using city streets and it allowed participation from a wide variety of marchers, still, the parade organizers had a right to control who could march. And then more recently, 303 Creative said that a website designer could not be compelled to design websites for same-sex marriages, despite Colorado's anti-discrimination law. And people are probably thinking of other examples of conservatives invoking the First Amendment to prevent the state from compelling them to provide services to historically discriminated against groups. Hobby Lobby rejected the requirement that employer-provided health insurance has to include coverage of birth control. Maybe a little less familiar is National Institute of Family and Life Advocates versus Becerra, which held that a state cannot compel businesses who are offering so-called crisis pregnancy counseling to also make available accurate information regarding the availability of abortion services. So if the Supreme Court now says, despite all of that, the state may compel a social media company to allow in election deniers on their platform, it will serve to further this perception that the court is an ideological body that's not concerned with analytical consistency. Essentially, a business's ability to control its message or not, but it has editorial discretion, or rather can be compelled to allow speech from disruptive and bigoted actors, is going to, that right is going to correspond with whether or not that message is one that will be liked by conservatives or progressives.
Yes, thank you for reminding us of those previous cases, Zach. Hopefully some good may come out of that history. Turning back to the SCOTUS arguments, appellate lawyer Paul Clement went on to give the opening argument in Net Choice versus Paxton. Let's take a listen to that.
We will hear argument next in case 22555, Net Choice versus Paxton. Mr. Clement.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I don't want to proceed as if I wasn't here for the first argument, so let me focus on what's different about Texas. One thing, fortunately, that's different about Texas is its definition of social media platforms excludes websites. So we can just put that Gmail issue to one side for when we're talking about Texas. The other thing it excludes, of course, is websites that are primarily focused on news, sports, and entertainment. In the First Amendment business, we call that content-based discrimination. And that's just one of the many reasons that this statute is, dare I say it, facially unconstitutional. The other thing that's different is in some respects this statute operates more simply because it forbids my clients from engaging in viewpoint discrimination. Now, we're used to thinking that viewpoint discrimination is a bad thing and that government shouldn't do it. And of course, when governments do it, it is a bad thing. But when editors or speakers engage in viewpoint discrimination, that is their First Amendment right. It is also absolutely vital to the operation of these websites, because if you have to be viewpoint neutral, that means that if you have materials that are involved in suicide prevention, you also have to have materials that advocate suicide promotion. Or if you have materials on your site that are pro-Semitic, then you have to let on materials onto your site that are anti-Semitic. And that is a formula for making these websites very unpopular to both users and advertisers. So it is absolutely vital. The other thing that makes Texas a little different is, at least in passing the law, Texas was even more explicit in relying on the common carrier analogy, as if simply labeling websites common carriers makes the First Amendment problems go away. And that is fundamentally wrong for two basic reasons. One, these companies don't operate actually as common carriers. They all have terms of use that exclude varying degrees of content. And second, Texas can't simply convert them into public common carriers by its say-so. I welcome the court's questions.
That was Paul Clement giving the opening argument in Net Choice versus Paxton. Zach, as you know, U.S. law describes a common carrier as a private or public entity that transports goods or people from one place to another for a fee. The term is also used to describe telecommunications services and public utilities. The word common is the noteworthy distinction. Common carriers like buses offer services to the general public, unlike private carriers that may be available only to specific clients on a contractual basis. Utilities are considered common carriers because they make no distinction in who their customers are. It's available to anyone in its coverage area who is willing to pay their fee. I personally think common carriers like phones and utilities function on a substantively different level than social media platforms because they can serve as lifelines for individuals who need to access vital services like ambulances or fire departments. What are your reactions to all of this?
I think that's absolutely right. And they're also different because of the social nature of social media versus a private use of a telecommunication service. So going back to my example from the start of our conversation about school shooting deniers, people who want to call school shootings hoaxes can talk on the phone to each other without harming the ability of parents and student activists to connect with like-minded individuals. Not so on social media posts. Currently, if someone posts on social media about being a survivor or being afraid of a school shooting or wanting to work on gun control, then the algorithm can identify that user as someone who might want to see posts from other survivors, from support organizations, from activist groups like Everytown for Gun Safety or Students Demand Action. But if Texas and Florida are allowed to give those deniers a kind of most favored nation status on social media, then the social media platforms would be compelled to provide and promote the denier posts on users' feeds in the same way they would promote those other posts. So that would cause a lot of disruption for any efforts to reach out and identify new anti-shooting activists, to create supportive communities for survivors, and not just because the posts that those survivors need to see are going to get lost in the din, but also because the platform becomes a hostile environment where survivors aren't going to want to be spending their time. A Pew Research study from back in 2020 found that 41% of Americans have personally experienced some form of online harassment. And there's every reason to believe that that has only gotten worse in the past few years. And that's with moderation being legal. So it's just not the same as providing telecommunication services or other utility access. This is another issue, but I would argue that it makes sense to designate ISPs as common carriers. But there just isn't a match with social media platforms, either in terms of the rationale for why we would call them a common carrier or for the social costs of banning moderation.
I agree with that. Zach, another issue the justices considered is application of Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. In a nutshell, Section 230 generally provides immunity for online computer services with respect to third-party content generated by its users. It promotes free speech by removing strong incentives for platforms to limit what we can say and do online. But notably, before Section 230 was enacted, companies cultivating online communities were legally responsible for what their users posted.
And this is where social media corporations and progressive activists are going to part ways, and actually where the companies find themselves in a little bit of a bind. The platforms, the social media corporations, are pushing materials to users in ways that, at least I would argue, should be more carefully regulated and for which they should be held liable when their product design causes harm. But, of course, the companies want to claim free speech rights without acknowledging that they're engaged in the kind of speech that might actually fall outside of 230 immunity.
Let's take a listen to a very short exchange on Section 230. This is between Paul Clement and members of the court.
It's speech for purposes of the First Amendment, your speech, your editorial control. But when we get to Section 230, your submission is that that isn't your speech.
Yes, as a matter of statutory construction, because otherwise Section 230 ends up being self-defeating. Because, again, the whole point of Section 230 was to promote that editorial discretion. And this court, you know, this court wrestled with these issues. They're hard issues. And I certainly applaud the instinct that you shouldn't resolve them here. But I don't think just by recognizing that my clients are engaged in editorial discretion when they make those decisions about what's going to ultimately go to the individualized screen that a user's going to see when they tap into their website or their application. I don't think that's the kind of speech that is you're talking about in the 230 context. And if you did, I think you would defeat the fundamental purpose of 230 because they wanted you. They wanted my clients and others to exercise that editorial discretion to keep the bad material
with
out.
With respect to other people's speech. So it seems like we have speech and then we have speech.
You can't, you literally, and this is, again, I'm happy to argue that case right now if we want to, but you can't have
Section 230. Well, no, it's a really hard question for us, and it's perfectly relevant here and very important because, of course, 230 preempts things, and we don't know how much of this law it preempts.
Absolutely, but this law is unconstitutional in all its applications, and certainly in its, it has no plainly legitimate sweep. So you don't have to reach the 230 question directly here. And I would simply say that when you're reading those statutory terms in 230, you wouldn't sweep in editorial discretion, because if you do, you will defeat the fundamental purpose of Section 230, which is to empower editorial discretion.
Well, I just wanted to raise with you the question I raised with the Solicitor General, who offered a thoughtful response. But many of your clients' terms of service, while reserving some editorial discretion, and I think about most of them as speaking about the things covered by 230, obscenity, et cetera, go out of their way to promise an open forum to all members of the public and go out of their way to say we don't endorse what other people say on this site and go out of their way to say all views shall flourish. Now, that's not true for all of your clients, but it's true for some of them and many of them. What do we do about that?
That was part of an exchange between appellate attorney Paul Clement and several justices from last month's oral arguments in the case Moody v. NetChoice and NetChoice v. Paxton. Zach, in terms of Section 230 liability, we have to mention cases against three tech giants. You'll recall that U.S. citizen Noemi Gonzalez was killed by a terrorist attack in France back in 2015. The next day, ISIS claimed responsibility and released a YouTube video. Gonzalez's father sued Google, Twitter, and Facebook, claiming, among other things, that all three platforms were liable for aiding and abetting international terrorism. He said they failed to take meaningful action to prevent terrorists from using its services. Then in 2023, in Twitter v. Tomnet, the Supreme Court unanimously declined to impose secondary liability on tech companies for allegedly failing to prevent ISIS from using their platforms for recruiting, fundraising, and organizing. How do those cases relate to this?
So really importantly, those rulings that you just mentioned, the lawsuits against Twitter and Google as parent company for YouTube, held that the Anti-Terrorism Act, which is the law under which those plaintiffs were suing, does not reach the sort of conduct that that suit alleged. Essentially, the ruling was that providing a platform used by terrorists doesn't constitute aiding and abetting or providing material support. So the court didn't reach the Section 230 immunity issue. It was a big win for social media corporations, but it did not insulate them from all lawsuits alleging harm by the design of their products or the functioning of their algorithms, as long as the claims being brought against them are for violation of laws other than the Anti-Terrorism Act. And there are just such lawsuits going forward right now against social media companies. For example, two major cases brought by states and by parents alleging that social media is designed to maximize screen time in a way that's especially harmful to young people, and that it aggravates body image issues and bullying and other sorts of social problems. So as a larger point, I would say that those sorts of lawsuits are an example of why the Florida and Texas laws are not what we need. The law has ways to require social media companies to do better at protecting against the harm that their platforms can cause. As I said at the start, the Florida and Texas laws are just not aimed at the real damages and harm from social media. But existing product liability and negligence laws and other kinds of doctrines can be directed at social media companies in ways that would not cause the sorts of problems that we've been discussing of requiring them to promote posts from school shooting deniers the same way they do survivor networks. If anyone wants to follow those sorts of lawsuits, the lawsuits by the parents have been consolidated as In Re Social Media Adolescent Addiction / Personal Injury Product Liability Litigation, it's a long one, and it advances claims based on consumer protection laws, negligence, and fraudulent concealment. And then there's an action by 33 states captioned Arizona versus Meta that brings claims for false advertising and violations of various business regulations and consumer protection laws.
Zach, we're running out of our allotted time. A quick question. If you were on the Supreme Court, how would you rule in these two cases?
Highly hypothetical scenario. But you know, one of the most fundamental premises of free speech is that we keep the government out of the role of censor, and we let the marketplace of ideas work out the best approaches to social issues. There's obviously limits on that, like with negligence and product liability, like I was just discussing. There's also fraud and harassment and any number of other concepts that can be brought to bear. But how do we create this sort of modern salon of online communities without allowing them to be disrupted by bigots and conspiracy theorists is a problem that the people need to be allowed to figure out. And there are strong efforts underway trying to figure out how to do that. The Santa Clara Principle started out as human rights activists, set of ideas from human rights activists and academics about how do we deal with hate speech online, and it's now been endorsed by some of the major players in the space. The issue continues to get attention from activists and scholars, including even the National Academy of Sciences recently. We obviously need more of this, demanding corporate responsibility from the social media companies, and I'm sure we'll get it. But on this law, on these cases, I would just strike down the Florida and Texas laws and let that litigation, social activism, and experimentation unfold and find the better way forward.
Mm. I love that, Zach. And when I'm president, I'm going to nominate you to the High Court. Zach Wolf, your insights are always appreciated. We look forward to having you back when the High Court comes forth with its ruling so that we can analyze what they decide. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heidi. This was wonderful.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. International human aid organizations have been documenting and warning that Israel was committing crimes of war after bombing Gaza after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attacks. Yet major media outlets and social media platforms have consistently ignored these on-the-ground reports. As Israel's attacks escalated into acts of genocide, corporate media coverage has largely framed such violence as defensive and justified. Glaringly absent has been reporting on Israel's long-established use of violence and deprivation against Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, and occupied East Jerusalem. As we've been covering on Law and Disorder, 50 years after Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, it has systematically repressed and abused the rights of the Palestinian population. It's long recognized by most state and international bodies that Israeli settlements themselves are illegal under international law. And Gaza's government media office has reported that at least 126 Palestinian journalists have been killed since Israel's war began on October 7th. What factors have contributed to Israel avoiding moral and legal culpability for its acts of genocide? As it turns out, there are many, from Israel employing propaganda, falsifying evidence, to the censorship and silencing of U.S. journalists and commentators, as well as repression of dissident voices online and off. And powerful Israeli lobbying forces have effectively silenced any criticism of Israel. To explore these issues, our guest today is award-winning author Robin Anderson. Robin is Professor Emerita of Media Studies at Fordham University. She writes media criticism for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and many other outlets, and works with Project Censored as a contributor to its annual State of the Free Press book. Her book, A Century of Media, A Century of War, won the Alpha Sigma Nu Book Award in 2007. Robin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Heidi.
Now, Robin, since we're going to be talking about media, let's start with some terminology. What is legacy media?
Legacy media is things that have been around for a long time. So it's the New York Times, it's the Washington Post, so the papers of record, network television. Sometimes I think CNN has been around for a very long time, and it has, but you know it came online as a cable network. So it's just another way of talking about old big media.
Robin, please describe how legacy media has been describing victims of Israel's war crimes, including the photographic coverage.
Right. Well, what comes to mind right away, Michael, is that victims are not seen as real people, just like Hamas was demonized at the beginning of the genocide. There's various ways that they're even demonizing Palestinians as they're being bombed and starved. So, for example, in the latest flower massacre, the Palestinians were said to be trampling on one another and stampeding like a mob. And the Economist went so far as to say that anarchy is ruling in Gaza, and saying that the convoy was set upon by these starving people, and as if the convoy was the one that was murdered, or the convoy was murdered and not the people of Palestine. So, you know, Israeli victims after October 7th were slaughtered and massacred, and Palestinian are further dehumanized by simply using the abstract language of numbers and not really being humanized.
It sounds like a massive public relations undertaking. Robin, what are the primary forces that serve to keep the public from learning about Israel's genocidal actions toward Palestinians in Gaza?
Right, Heidi. AIPAC and other Israeli lobby groups have been very good over the last decade, really. They've been around much longer than that, but really accelerated their activities by creating a public sphere where it hasn't been safe to criticize the state of Israel. We've seen the term anti-Semitism brought against many Jews, and certainly many non-Jews, who have called for a ceasefire, who have identified genocide. Any way that we've criticized this, it has been attacked. And as I say, this comes from a long line of doing this. Most recently, if we look at the Academy Awards, where you've got the zone of interest, and you've got Glazer up there who's just received the prize as the Academy Award, and he says, you know, we refute our Jewishness and the occupation, and we're tired of it being carried out in our names. So that was immediately stopped after we refute our Jewishness by the Newsweek editor, opinion editor. This amazing person who just did a film about the Holocaust and has said demonization, it's not only about then, it's about what's happening now. And refusing to allow his Jewishness to be used to justify the occupation and the genocide. He's actually called anti-Semitic. So, you know, in 2016, as Rashid Halidi reported in his book, The 100-Year War on Palestine, public opinion in the United States started to go toward Palestine. Polls showed that there was a shift, and people had become more critical of the state of Israel and seeing that conflict more through the eyes of the Palestinians. And AIPAC and Canary Mission and Honest Reporting, all these lobby groups have had big effects on our institutions, universities, student activities, and in journalism as well.
Robin, talk more, if you will, please, about the Israeli lobbying machine. It seems to be targeting students, organizations, individuals, and the media. Tell us about the lobbying machine, please.
Right. Well, there's a group called Honest Reporting, and they've been instrumental in getting some journalists fired. There was this wonderful Palestinian photojournalist who worked for the New York Times for 4 years. They dug up, Honest Reporting said, he made this Facebook post that was pro-Palestinian. So the New York Times fired him. We saw that the president of Harvard was targeted and she was fired. We've seen this over and over again. Lamont Hill on CNN a year and a half ago was fired from his commentary position because he attended a Palestinian day at the United Nations, and that was CNN. We know, of course, that Mehdi Hassan was taken off of the air. Well, he was taken off of his show, and then he retired from MSNBC because he wasn't going to be demoted like that. But there's many different organizations, but we know that the great book by Ryan Grimm, now writes for The Intercept, published AOC and the Promise of the Squad, and documented the way AIPAC has primaried, the word that we use for, challenged any politician who has been critical of the state of Israel, challenging them in the primaries and giving millions of dollars to any candidate who will oppose them, who toes the line on the state of Israel. So all of these forces have been in play, and we see them now in a real effort to create consensus, to manufacture consensus against, if you will, any critical voices being able to be heard in our public and media discourse.
Robin, we hear so much now about so-called fake news, doctored images, artificial intelligence. Are you aware of any instances where pro-Israel media may have altered images or presented what we call fake news, disinformation?
The easiest thing to do mostly online is to misidentify footage. And we don't really know, you know, the motivation behind it. Sometimes an incident that was reported online, some Israelis beat up Palestinians, it could be a time when it was not at the present, and it was labeled as something that was happening now on the West Bank or something. We don't know who posts those. Those could be posted to discredit Palestinians. On either side, though, that can happen, and that's the most common way. I don't think at this point, and certainly not now, it is fairly easy to detect when a photograph has been altered, that we saw in Kate Middleton, the princess, when she'd been out of the public view for a while. That image was clearly, it was silly for them to post it. It was clearly altered. For example, the Israelis, when they've committed a war crime against Al-Shifa Hospital, for example, they put up audio tape that was supposed to be a conversation between a jihadist and a Hamas fighter. They were saying that they targeted the hospital. The tape wasn't in the right dialect of Arabic. It was clearly altered. They didn't speak in the proper accents. Those kinds of things have been identified. How the Israelis have been using it, also in the latest flower massacre, is they put up aerial footage. And then people easily saw that it was in four segments. And the moment at which the IDF shoots and lobs missiles at the starving Palestinians trying to collect aid from the convoy, they've taken that out. So the way the Israelis have been using that is not that they don't understand that they're going to be found out. It's that they're always buying for time. Each time they buy for time, the video gets discussed ad infinitum in the media. It takes up all the space, all the news cycle on the particular event, and then they move over to another event. So the Israeli flower massacre has now been allowed to simply pass us by, completely being lost in this befuddling dialogue of back and forth. Really, the Hamas never gets to say anything. It's what the Israeli health ministry documents always posted against and put in contrast to official Israeli statements. So I think that right now, in this moment in time, that's the way fake videos and altered things we need to really point out have been very instrumental in prolonging and buying time for the genocide and allowing them to get away with basically war crime after war crime.
How does the U.S. military-industrial complex inform this virtual blackout in coverage of Israelis' war crimes?
Well, I was just on a panel with Project Censored and the Media Education Foundation, and we were talking about a film that documents the long history of the Pentagon's role in Hollywood and shaping Hollywood films, and not just Hollywood films, but all aspects of programming by, filmmakers make huge profits. If they allow their scripts to be put through the censors at the Pentagon, then they reap the benefits of all of the massive weaponry. And this, of course, is at the taxpayers' expense. So if you want to access to these powerful movies directed by Michael Bay and Jerry Bruckheimer, for example, Pearl Harbor and Black Hawk Down and those kinds of films, they have gone through a censor. What the censors of the military and the Pentagon at the Office of Liaisons, what they take out are any kind of things that challenges military hierarchy. The themes that are routinely censored are war crimes, any mention of illegal activity on the part of the U.S. military. And so we've got this. Oh, this has been going on for over 30 years now. And just so if people are interested in seeing this incredible documentation full of clips from mainstream films and then on to cooking shows and things like that, the name of the film is Theaters of War. And it is produced by the Media Education Foundation. The way I see it as getting us ready for to accept a genocide is that over the years they've created a very pro-military, kind of militarized culture that dominates the silver screen, the small screen, video games. When we know that there are propaganda messages, for example, those propaganda messages are better accepted if there's kind of a background, foundational way of thinking that goes along with the atrocities. So when people are hearing on October 7th, for example, that Hamas engaged in mass rape, that they just killed all of these civilians, they're terrorists, they're dehumanized, that it expands into Palestine and Gaza. And when you get these Israeli officials saying, you know, we're going to have this huge response, there's going to be no food, no electricity, there's going to be nothing. They wanted hell, we'll give them hell, we'll turn it into a tent city. That kind of demonization that a group and a people have been identified as subhuman and non-human, that allows that kind of military response. If we think of blockbuster movies influenced by the Pentagon, these are not complex, nuanced narratives. These are narratives that divide the world between an easily identified, dehumanized enemy and the wonderful effects of U.S. intervention, how it's benevolent and how it goes in to save people or take out an enemy or things like that. So that's how I believe our utter lack of criticism of the Pentagon, also in any kind of budgetary. We never hold them accountable in the press. It's become this very bipartisan push for more and more military aid. And we've known now that Biden has sent 100 shipments of military aid to Israel. But knowing that that's so unpopular, it's been done in secret. So these are the way I think these things interact in public discourse and are played out in real horrifying ways now, as we see in the Gaza genocide.
And Robin, it certainly doesn't help that we see a proliferation of junior ROTC programs in public schools around the nation to really reinforce that kind of Pentagon aspect that you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And part of the mandate of Hollywood films such as Act of Valor, which started out as an advertisement for the Army, the mandate for that. But, of course, what we know also is that commercial funding for R&D development for so many of our video games that children really love are openly designed as also part of recruitment and have been for many years. I've written a lot about Call of Duty and things like that, and I interviewed a couple of ROTC students when I was at Fordham, and they talked about using video games in training and how the recruiters come to the new launches of each new video game and affect recruiting. So those things feed into this culture where it basically becomes acceptable if you don't have a lot of money to go to school, you accept ROTC, and if you need an income, you join the Army. That's what also we've been seeing over the years.
Now, Robin, all of this makes it sound as though American media outlets and entertainment have become genocide apologists. Does pro-Israel U.S. media coverage make our nation complicit in genocide, in your opinion?
Oh, I absolutely believe that's true. And there are a couple of suits, one by CCR, as we know, that has made that argument in the Biden administration. I believe that the way the media parroted the pro-Israeli statements, always have taken everything they said and run with them, that is to say, repeated any justification for a war crime from bombing a hospital, from bombing refugees in transit, from bombing people seeking aid. These are all crimes against humanity. And every single time the Israelis get caught doing it, U.S. media has condoned and repeated their explanations and questioned anything coming out of the Gaza Health Ministry and belittling and denying those facts. And also the complete erasure within the public sphere of international aid organizations, humanitarian aid. Save the Children, for example, says what we're seeing now in Gaza is the worst-case scenario being played out. UNICEF has said the same thing. The people who, Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, has said this is a war crime. They're denying people food. So there's currently an engineered famine in Gaza. And the U.S. media is complicit in not reporting that on the ground, where you had Al Jazeera reporters, you had Euromed staff, you have testimonials, you have footage from on the ground, instead of acting as real journalists and taking and finding the footage and telling what happened when, they're simply repeating Israeli denials that justify these murders. And I believe at some point over the course of this, it's going to be discovered that journalists and media outlets have to have been well aware that these things were happening. Certainly from a moral and ethical point of view, for the mandate of journalism, they are complicit in genocide. I believe from the mandate of journalism, what we've identified so many times is not journalism. It's dressed up rhetoric or fictionist prose. It's not the conveying of information to active citizens so they can participate in a democratic process. That's the mandate of journalism. They have not been fulfilling that. In terms of the op-ed pages of the New York Times, all we need to do is look at Thomas Friedman's metaphors that are historically openly genocidal, where he likens the Palestinian people to wasps and Hamas to wasps. locusts and insects that eat out individuals. And Fair did a fantastic job of pointing that out, complete with an image from Nazi Germany that shows a spider eating people. Of course, the spider represents Jews. And as the director that got the award for Zone of Interest said, that kind of demonization is not in the past. He didn't make the film to talk about it was in the past. He talked about it as now. And we know that the first step of genocide is demonization.
This is Law and Disorder Radio. I'm attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian, and we're speaking with Robin Anderson, whose critique of the media has been profound. Robin, talk about social media's role in advancing a pro-Israel narrative, please.
Well, there are what people call pro-Israeli apologists online. Caitlin Johnson, the commentator that I like the best. They will create cover for any aspect of what's going on in Gaza. What I think the most damning things that the IDF itself has been posting are its own soldiers who are mocking the Palestinians as they blow them up. As they kill them, they cheer. You see things online that are happening in Israel that you don't see in the mainstream press. You see so many atrocities on the field, and you see most notably and interestingly, so many of these IDF soldiers have gone through Palestinian homes and pulled out women's underwear, and they can be seen wearing their lingerie or brassieres over their uniforms and dancing around in them. These things are being very well documented. We're trying to get a handle on the social dynamics of that and the social psychology of it. But it seems that they feel no boundaries between what they can do to Palestinians and how they can even put those images over online.
Robin, I hate to say it, but we're running out of our allotted time. We could listen to you for a full hour. How can our listeners follow your work?
Oh, I can be found on various platforms such as Project Censored, Fair, Counterpunch. The first piece I wrote about Palestine and Israelis' attack on the Palestinians kind of went across a variety of platforms. But I guess the best place to find me is on Fair.
Terrific. Robin, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Been great talking to you both. Thanks.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with constitutional scholar Steve Rohde about three significant Supreme Court decisions that are pending or just came down.
Are these cases an indication of the rapidly declining democracy in our country? Stay tuned. We also speak with Palestinian solidarity activist Felice Gelman about her new short video, The Right to Boycott.
The right to boycott is being challenged by the ultra-right forces in this country. So far, 37 states have passed laws against it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. The U.S. Supreme Court, securely under the control of a supermajority of six conservative Republican justices, three of whom were appointed by Donald Trump, continues to play a decisive role in undermining our constitutional democracy. This ominous trend continues based on three recent key cases, which we'll be talking about today. In one, the court on March 4th rejected a lower court ruling that Trump was ineligible to run for president. In April, the court will hear oral arguments on Trump's claim of absolute immunity from criminal liability And recently, the justices heard argument over whether social media sites had a right to ban Trump and others under their content moderation standards. All of these cases arise from the insurrection on January 6, 2021, when a mob of thousands stormed the U.S. Capitol to prevent Joe Biden from being certified as president. That day, and for many months before and after,